A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the permanent residency status of East Jerusalem Palestinians. What rights does it actually confer? And what sets it apart from full Israeli citizenship? How was the decision made back in 1967 to create this unique kind of semi-citizenship? And given that most East Jerusalemites reject the legitimacy of the Jerusalem municipality, how do they actually feel about being stuck in this in-between status? Plus the really practical question. If someone wants to move to Ramallah or anywhere governed by the Palestinian Authority, can they? Or does this limbo status mean they can't really live in Palestinian areas either?
That last question is the one that catches people off guard every time. Most people assume East Jerusalem Palestinians have the worst of both worlds, can't fully participate in Israel, but at least they can go live in the West Bank. The reality is almost the reverse. They're trapped in Jerusalem more completely than either Israeli citizens or West Bank Palestinians.
A golden cage where leaving means losing everything.
And it's not rhetorical. It's a specific legal mechanism called the Center of Life Requirement. But before we get to the mobility trap, let's establish what this status actually is, because the terminology itself is misleading. Permanent residency in Israel sounds like a green card, a stepping stone to citizenship. It's not. If you're an American listening to this, you're probably imagining something like the path from green card holder to naturalized citizen. Put in your years, pass the test, get the passport. This is fundamentally different.
What is it, precisely? Break down the actual legal architecture.
It's governed by the Entry into Israel Law from 1952, and it's completely separate from the Citizenship Law of the same year. These are parallel legal tracks that never intersect by design. A permanent resident has the right to live and work in Israel, access to Bituach Lumi, that's the national social security system, full national health insurance coverage, and the right to vote in municipal elections. That last one surprises people.
They can vote for the mayor of Jerusalem, but not for the Knesset. That's a very specific slice of political participation.
No national vote, no Israeli passport. They get what's called a laissez-passer, a travel document that looks like a passport but isn't one. And here's the crucial difference. The status is conditional. It's tied to proving that your center of life is in Israel, which for East Jerusalemites means East Jerusalem specifically. If you leave for an extended period, typically 7 years, the Ministry of Interior can revoke your residency. Think of it less like a green card and more like a lease agreement with a particularly aggressive landlord who can evict you if they decide you've been spending too many nights elsewhere.
You can live in your family's home for decades, pay taxes, send your kids to school, get your health care, and still have the state treat you as a guest who might overstay. Your connection to the place is treated as provisional, no matter how deep your roots actually go.
Between 1967 and 2020, over 14,000 East Jerusalemites had exactly that happen. Their residency was revoked. Hey Mokad, the Israeli human rights organization, has been tracking this for decades. In 2021 alone, 225 people lost their status, up from 89 the year before. The Ministry of Interior cited breach of trust or center of life violations.
Breach of trust. That's a phrase worth sitting with. It sounds like something out of a marriage, not an administrative procedure.
It's deliberately vague, and it's become more prominent in recent years. The current government's legislative agenda for 2025 to 2026 includes proposed bills to revoke permanent residency explicitly for breach of loyalty to the state. That's new language. We're moving from, you weren't physically here enough to, you were here, but we don't like what you think or say or do.
Let's go back to the beginning. 1967. The Six-Day War ends. Israel has just captured East Jerusalem from Jordan. What happens in the rooms where this status gets invented? Who's in there, and what are they arguing about?
This is where it gets fascinating. The war ends on June 10th. By June 28th, 18 days later, the Knesset passes the Law and Administration Ordinance, Amendment No. 11, and the Municipalities Ordinance, Amendment No. 6. These two pieces of legislation extend Israeli law, jurisdiction, and administration to East Jerusalem. It's de facto annexation, though Israel's Supreme Court later described it as administrative unification, carefully avoiding the word annexation. The linguistic gymnastics started from day one.
Because annexation has legal consequences under international law. You can't just say the A word and pretend everything's fine.
Specifically, the Fourth Geneva Convention, Article 49, which prohibits an occupying power from transferring parts of its own civilian population into occupied territory. If Israel openly annexed East Jerusalem, it would be in direct violation, so the legal framing matters enormously. You call it unification, you call it administrative extension, you call it anything except annexation, and then you structure the residents' legal status to match that ambiguity.
The people living there? Roughly 70,000 Palestinians in East Jerusalem at that point.
About 66,000, according to the census data from the period, and the cabinet debates in June and July of 1967. Some of these are declassified now, available in the Israel State Archives, show three competing considerations. Moshe Dayan, the defense minister, and Prime Minister Levi Eshkol were deeply worried that offering full citizenship to 70,000 Palestinians would dilute the Jewish majority in a unified Jerusalem. The whole point of unification was to create an undivided Jewish capital. Adding tens of thousands of new Arab citizens undermined that arithmetic. You'd be uniting the city geographically while dividing it demographically against yourself.
They wanted the land but not the people on it, or at least not as full political participants.
That's the tension that runs through this entire history. Second consideration, the international law fig leaf, permanent residency rather than citizenship, allowed Israel to claim it wasn't fully annexing the territory or its population. It was extending administrative control while leaving the residents' formal nationality ambiguous. The legal gymnastics were intentional. If anyone at the UN asked, Israel could say, look, we haven't made them citizens, we're just administering the area, this is all provisional. Israel wanted the economy integrated, the infrastructure connected, the city functioning as one unit, but without granting political equality. Permanent residency let them have it both ways. East Jerusalemites could work in the Israeli economy, access services, pay taxes, but they couldn't shape national policy through voting. They'd be economic participants but political non-entities. It's a remarkably efficient design if your goal is extracting the benefits of integration without sharing power.
The status was designed from day one as a tool for managing a contradiction. Annexation without equality. Control without political integration. You get their labor and their taxes, but they don't get a say in how the country is run.
Here's the detail that complicates the narrative. Israel did technically offer citizenship. The 1967 Law of Citizenship, Amendment No. 2, allowed East Jerusalem residents to apply for Israeli citizenship. It wasn't automatic. You had to apply, demonstrate basic Hebrew proficiency, and swear allegiance to the State of Israel. Fewer than 5% applied in those first 3 years. Estimates from the Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research put it at about 12 to 15% who've taken citizenship. The reasons for not applying are layered. Some is political rejection. Accepting Israeli citizenship means legitimizing the annexation. Some is fear of being seen as collaborators by the broader Palestinian community. And the allegiance oath is genuinely offensive to people who see themselves as Palestinians living under occupation. You're asking someone to swear loyalty to the state that just showed up and took over their city 3 weeks ago.
There's also a practical disincentive, right? If you take Israeli citizenship, you might lose something on the Palestinian side.
Jordanian citizenship in many cases. Before 1967, East Jerusalemites were Jordanian citizens. After annexation, Jordan didn't want to create statelessness, so many retained Jordanian passports. But taking Israeli citizenship can complicate that, and for families with property or connections in Jordan, and we're talking about extended family networks, inheritance issues, business ties, that's a real deterrent. You're not just making a political statement by refusing citizenship, you're protecting material interests.
The low naturalization rate isn't just political theater. There are material trade-offs. You might lose your Jordanian passport, your ability to travel freely in the Arab world, your family's property claims in Amman.
That's what makes the misconception so frustrating. You'll hear people say, well, they were offered citizenship and they refused, as if it was a generous offer they simply spurned. But the offer was structured to be politically and practically unacceptable to most East Jerusalemites. It required swearing allegiance to a state that had just occupied their city. It potentially severed ties to Jordan. And it was framed not as a right, but as a discretionary privilege. The Minister of Interior could deny any application without giving a reason. Imagine someone takes your house, then offers to let you apply for a bedroom, but you have to thank them for it, and they can say no for no reason at all. That's the structure.
Let's talk about the center of life trap. This phrase gets thrown around, but what's the actual mechanism? How does the state determine whether you've abandoned your center of life?
The Ministry of Interior, specifically the Population and Immigration Authority, requires permanent residents to prove that their center of life is in Israel. For East Jerusalemites, that means East Jerusalem. If you move your primary residence to Ramallah, or you go study abroad for an extended period, or you spend more than 7 years living outside Jerusalem, the ministry can initiate revocation proceedings.
How do they determine this? What's the evidence threshold? Are we talking about a casual check or something more invasive?
It's remarkably invasive. They look at utility bills, school enrollment for children, employment records, lease agreements, bank statements. They'll interview neighbors. They'll check how many days per year you physically spent in Jerusalem. It's a comprehensive surveillance of your daily life, and the burden of proof is on the resident to demonstrate they haven't left. You have to prove you're still here. They don't have to prove you've gone.
You're guilty until you prove yourself innocent of the crime of living somewhere else. The state assumes you've abandoned your residency unless you can document otherwise.
Between 1967 and 2020, over 14,000 people couldn't meet that burden. Their residency was revoked. Once revoked, they're treated as foreigners. They lose health insurance, social security, the right to work. They can be barred from re-entering Jerusalem, even if their family has lived there for generations. I want to give you a concrete example here because the numbers can feel abstract. There was a case documented by Hamokid involving a woman born in East Jerusalem in 1958. She lived there her entire life, raised her children there, buried her parents there. In 2014, she moved to a West Bank village about 20 minutes away to live with her daughter while receiving cancer treatment. The Ministry of Interior initiated revocation proceedings because her utility bills and medical records showed she was receiving treatment outside Jerusalem. She was too ill to fight it effectively. She lost her status in 2016. Her family home in East Jerusalem, where her son still lives, is now a place she needs special permission to visit.
That's devastating. And it shows how the Center of Life test doesn't distinguish between moving for opportunity and moving for survival. She wasn't abandoning Jerusalem, she was getting medical care.
The law doesn't care about the reason. It cares about the physical fact of where you sleep, where your bills are sent, where your medical records are generated. Intent is irrelevant.
What about marriage? If an East Jerusalemite marries someone from the West Bank, what happens then?
This is where the 1995 family unification freeze comes in. After the Oslo Accords, Israel essentially stopped processing family unification applications for East Jerusalem residents married to West Bank Palestinians. So if you're an East Jerusalem permanent resident and you marry someone from Ramallah, your spouse can't get residency. You have to choose, live apart, or leave Jerusalem and lose your status.
That's brutal. How many families does this affect?
Hamokid estimates tens of thousands. Some couples live separated. The East Jerusalem spouse stays in the city to maintain their status. The West Bank spouse lives in Ramallah or Bethlehem, and they meet when they can. Others decide to move to the West Bank together and forfeit the Jerusalem residency. There's no good option. And think about what that does to the fabric of families. You have children who grow up seeing one parent on weekends. You have spouses who can't live together in the city where one of them was born. You have people making an impossible choice between their marriage and their home.
If they choose the marriage and move to the West Bank, they're not just losing an ID card. They're losing their health care, their social security, their legal right to work in Israel, their access to the city where they grew up.
Their children's future. If you lose your residency, your children born after the revocation don't get Jerusalem residency either. So one decision, moving to be with your spouse, cascades across generations.
We've established the legal architecture and the human costs. Let's get to the question about how East Jerusalemites themselves view this status. What does the polling tell us? Because I think there's an assumption that they'd all want citizenship if they could get it.
The Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research did a major survey in 2022. 68% of East Jerusalem Palestinians said they prefer permanent residency over Israeli citizenship. But, and this is the crucial point, it's for political reasons, not satisfaction with the status. They don't want to legitimize Israeli sovereignty by accepting citizenship. It's a rejection, not an endorsement. They're saying, we don't want your citizenship because we don't accept your claim to this city.
They're stuck in a status they reject on principle, but they can't leave without catastrophic loss, and they can't upgrade to citizenship without betraying their political identity. Every path is blocked by a different kind of wall.
They're paying for it. East Jerusalemites pay municipal taxes, arnona, at rates comparable to Jewish neighborhoods in West Jerusalem. But a 2020 State Comptroller report found that East Jerusalem receives about 30% less municipal spending per capita than West Jerusalem. Fewer services, worse infrastructure, less investment for the same tax burden. You're funding a municipality that systematically underfunds your neighborhood.
That's the municipal paradox. They can vote in municipal elections. They have that right. But do they?
Almost none do. In the 2018 Jerusalem municipal elections, 1.2% of eligible East Jerusalem voters participated. The boycott has held since 1967. The logic is consistent. Participating in the Jerusalem municipality would mean legitimizing Israeli rule over East Jerusalem. So they pay taxes to a municipality whose elections they boycott and receive substandard services in return. It's a perfect catch-22. If you vote, you're accepting the system. If you don't vote, you have no leverage to demand better services.
The poverty data bears this out.
According to the Jerusalem Institute, as of 2024, about 40% of East Jerusalem Palestinians live below the poverty line, compared to 22% in West Jerusalem. Part of that is the precariousness of the residency status limiting economic mobility. You can't easily take a job in Ramallah if it means risking your status. You can't study abroad for a PhD without careful documentation. Every life decision is filtered through the center of life calculus. Do I take that better-paying job if it means commuting across a checkpoint every day and potentially triggering a residency review? Do I accept that scholarship in Berlin if 4 years abroad might cost me my home?
Which brings us to Daniel's question about mobility. Can an East Jerusalemite move to Ramallah? What's the actual answer?
The Oslo Accords, specifically the 1995 Interim Agreement, gave the Palestinian Authority civil jurisdiction over East Jerusalemites in PA areas, so legally, there's nothing stopping someone from moving. But practically, it's devastating. If you move your center of life to Ramallah, you lose your Israeli permanent residency. That means you lose Israeli health insurance, you lose Social Security, you lose the right to work in Israel legally, and you may be permanently barred from re-entering Jerusalem.
Even to visit family? Even for a funeral or a wedding?
Even to visit. Once your residency is revoked, you're treated as a foreign national. You'd need a visitor's permit to enter Israel, which can be denied or restricted. Your family home, your parents, your community, potentially inaccessible. There are documented cases of people who couldn't attend their own parents' funerals in Jerusalem because their residency had been revoked and their permit application was denied. That's the level of severance we're talking about.
You're more tied to Jerusalem than an Israeli citizen who can move freely anywhere in the country, or a West Bank Palestinian who can move within PA areas. You're the least mobile of the three groups. The Israeli citizen can leave Jerusalem and come back. The West Bank Palestinian can move around the West Bank. The East Jerusalemite is pinned in place by the threat of losing everything.
That's the paradox that defines this status. East Jerusalemites are simultaneously more integrated than West Bank Palestinians. They're in the Israeli economy, the healthcare system, the tax system, and less integrated than Israeli citizens. No national vote, no passport, revocable status. They're in the most precarious position precisely because they're in the middle. It's like being in a doorway. You're neither fully inside nor fully outside, and the door could slam shut at any moment.
Let's compare this to other countries' permanent residency regimes, because I think that illuminates how unusual this is. Most people have some reference point for what permanent residency means.
Take the U.S. green card. You can naturalize after 5 years. There's no center of life revocation for moving abroad temporarily. You can leave for up to a year without losing status, and with a reentry permit, up to 2 years. Switzerland's C permit lets you naturalize after 10 years, and again, no revocation for moving within Switzerland. Canada's permanent residency requires you to be physically present for 2 out of every 5 years, but that's a rolling window, and you can naturalize after 3 years of residence. Israel's permanent residency for East Jerusalemites is unique in being explicitly non-citizenship track, and uniquely revocable based on where you choose to live. In most countries, permanent residency is a waiting room for citizenship. Here, it's a permanent waiting room with no door to the next room.
It's permanent in name only. Conditional permanent residency would be more accurate. Or revocable residency.
The conditions keep tightening. In 2023, there was the proposed Loyalty and Residence Bill, which would allow revocation for terrorist activity or breach of loyalty to the state, language that is deliberately broad enough to cover political speech or activism. The 2024 amendment to the Entry into Israel Law tightens center of life verification requirements even further. The trend is toward more revocations, not fewer. The screws are turning in one direction.
Let's talk about a concrete case, because the legal abstractions need grounding. The Siwan evictions. Walk me through what happened there and how the residency status played into it.
The Bataan Al-Hawa neighborhood in Siwan. In 2018, 12 Palestinian families faced eviction proceedings brought by settler organizations using the 1970 Legal and Administrative Matters Law. This law allows Jews to reclaim property in East Jerusalem if they can prove pre-1948 ownership. The families were permanent residents, not citizens, which meant they had fewer legal protections. They couldn't challenge the law's constitutionality in the same way a citizen might, and their precarious status made them more vulnerable to pressure. When you're a permanent resident fighting an eviction, you're doing it from a position of legal weakness. You don't have the full suite of constitutional protections. You're fighting with one hand tied behind your back.
The legal mechanism here, the 1970 law, applies only in East Jerusalem. It doesn't apply in West Jerusalem, so you have different property laws depending on which side of an invisible line you live on, even though the city is supposedly unified.
That's the deep contradiction of unified Jerusalem. The city is one municipality, but it operates under multiple legal regimes depending on who you are and where you live. Jewish residents of East Jerusalem are governed by Israeli civil law. Palestinian permanent residents are governed by a mix of Israeli law, Jordanian law that predates 1967, and military orders. It's a legal patchwork designed to maintain control while distributing rights unevenly. You can stand on one street in Siwan, and the house on your left is governed by one set of laws and the house on your right by another, and the determining factor is whether the occupants are Jewish or Palestinian.
This is the broader point, isn't it? The permanent residency status isn't an anomaly. It's a case study in how legal categories are used to manage demographic and political problems. It's not a bug in the system. It's the system working exactly as designed.
The status is a mirror of Israel's approach to the occupied territories more broadly. Maximum practical control with minimum political integration. You get the labor, the taxes, the economic activity, but not the vote, not the passport, not the security of status. It's governance without representation, made durable through legal architecture. And here's the thing, this isn't unique to Israel. Colonial powers have been using differentiated legal statuses to manage subject populations for centuries. The British did it with different categories of subjects in the empire. The French did it with their distinction between citizens and subjects in Algeria. The East Jerusalem permanent residency is a modern iteration of a very old playbook.
It was designed as a temporary measure. A stopgap in 1967 that's now approaching its 60th year. The temporary has a way of hardening into the permanent when no one is forced to resolve the underlying contradiction.
What was meant to be temporary has become permanent. That's the story of this status in one sentence. And the demographic pressure is building. East Jerusalem's Palestinian population is growing at about 2.5% annually, compared to 1.5% for the Jewish population. By 2035, projections suggest Palestinians will be roughly 40% of Jerusalem's total population. The permanent residency framework was designed for a small minority that could be managed at the margins. It's unclear whether it can survive demographic parity. When the managed population approaches half the city, the management tools start to look less like administration and more like apartheid.
Let's address some misconceptions head-on, because these come up constantly in coverage of this issue. I want to give listeners a clear set of corrections they can carry into conversations.
The biggest one, East Jerusalem Palestinians are Israeli citizens. They are not. They hold blue Israeli ID cards, which look identical to citizen ID cards, but the legal status printed on them is different. They cannot vote in the set elections. They carry a travel document, not a passport. The visual similarity of the ID cards creates confusion even among Israelis. I've had conversations with Israeli citizens who were surprised to learn that their East Jerusalem neighbors aren't citizens. They assumed the blue ID meant citizenship.
Second misconception, permanent residency is a path to citizenship, like a green card. As we've established, it's not. There's no automatic naturalization process. Applying for citizenship is discretionary. The Ministry of Interior can deny it, and it requires the allegiance oath that most find politically unacceptable. It's not a path, it's a cul-de-sac.
Third, East Jerusalemites can freely move to the West Bank and return. Moving their center of life to the West Bank triggers revocation. The 7-year threshold is not a grace period, it's a countdown.
Fourth, the status was a generous offer that Palestinians rejected. The status was unilaterally imposed. The citizenship option was structured to be unpalatable. Allegiance oath, discretionary approval, potential loss of Jordanian citizenship. Framing it as a generous offer ignores the coercive context. You can't occupy someone's city and then pat yourself on the back for offering them a second-class membership card.
There's a fifth misconception that's more subtle, that this is primarily a legal problem. It's not. It's a political problem managed through legal tools. Every aspect of this status, the center of life requirement, the revocation mechanism, the family unification freeze, is a policy choice, not a legal inevitability. The Knesset could change these laws tomorrow. The Ministry of Interior could issue different regulations. The courts could interpret the existing laws differently. None of this is written in stone.
What are the key takeaways from all of this? If someone listens to this episode and wants to walk away with a clear framework for understanding the situation, what should they hold on to?
First, permanent residency in Israel for East Jerusalemites is not a stepping stone to citizenship. It's a separate, parallel status explicitly designed to manage the contradiction between annexation and equality. Unlike permanent residency in most countries, it's not on a citizenship track by design. The architecture was built to prevent naturalization, not facilitate it.
Second, the center of life requirement creates a unique form of immobility. East Jerusalemites are more tied to Jerusalem than either Israeli citizens or West Bank Palestinians. Leaving means losing everything. Health insurance, social security, the right to work, the right to return. It's a golden cage, and the gold is real. The healthcare and social benefits are substantial, but it's still a cage.
Third, the status is a case study in how legal categories are weaponized to manage demographic and political problems. It's governance without representation, made durable through 60 years of legal architecture. The law doesn't just regulate behavior. It creates categories of people with different rights, different vulnerabilities, different futures. And once those categories exist, they take on a life of their own. People organize their lives around them. They become the water people swim in.
For listeners who want to go deeper, there are concrete resources worth engaging with. Amokud published a 2023 report called The Center of Life Trap, that documents individual cases and the administrative mechanisms in detail. B. Selim's 2022 report, A Policy of Discrimination, provides the broader framework. And for the legal architecture, the 2020 Supreme Court case HCJ 1000/20, Abu Arafeh versus the Minister of Interior, is the most recent major ruling on residency revocation. It's dense reading, but it shows how the courts have grappled with this.
Which brings us to the big open question. The current Israeli government has been actively discussing formal annexation of parts of the West Bank. That's been a live policy conversation throughout 2025 and into 2026. If annexation happens, what happens to the permanent residency model? Would it be extended to West Bank Palestinians? If so, what does that mean for the two-state solution, for Israeli democracy, for the demographic balance? You'd be taking a system designed for 66,000 people and potentially applying it to millions.
The demographic math is inescapable. East Jerusalem's Palestinian population is growing faster than the Jewish population. By 2035, Palestinians are projected to be 40% of Jerusalem. The permanent residency framework was built for a minority that could be managed. What happens when that minority approaches parity? When the managed population is no longer a minority, the management tools start to look less like governance and more like something much uglier.
The deeper question is whether any legal framework can sustainably manage a population that rejects the sovereignty under which it lives, pays taxes to a municipality it boycotts, and is tied to a city it cannot leave without catastrophic loss. That's not a stable equilibrium. Something eventually breaks, either the legal framework, the political context, or the people trapped inside it. You can't maintain a system built on contradiction forever. Contradictions have a way of resolving themselves, and not usually gently.
The story of East Jerusalem permanent residency is ultimately about how legal categories created as temporary compromises become permanent structures. What was meant to be a 1967 stopgap is now a 60-year-old institution, and the people living inside it are still waiting for the temporary to end. They've been waiting so long that the temporary has become the only reality their children and grandchildren have ever known.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, naturalists in the Namib Desert documented that the chemical composition of a bee's waggle dance pheromones varies by hive dialect. Worker bees from different colonies produce slightly different ratios of geraniol to citral, effectively creating chemically distinct regional accents that other bees can detect and sometimes reject. A bee from one valley might perform the exact same dance as a bee from the next valley, but the chemical signature marks her as an outsider, and the hive may refuse to act on her directions. It's a form of chemical xenophobia that operates entirely below the level of conscious recognition.
Even bees have immigration policies based on arbitrary chemical markers.
That one actually connects disturbingly well to the episode.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtob. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you got something out of this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.